And now I would like to introduce our speaker for this afternoon, who is Kim Bullimore. So Kim is a long-term socialist. She's also a Murray woman from North Queensland. She's one of the conveners of Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid here in Melbourne. And she was also has spent time living and working in Palestine with the International Women's Peace Service. So please make her very welcome.
Thanks, everybody, for coming on a Sunday afternoon. Just before we get started, as Rebecca said, I'm actually a Murray woman from Queensland. So, first of all, I just want to acknowledge that we're meeting on Aboriginal land, land that has never been ceded, and like to give my respects to elders past and present, and obviously this is the Wurundjeri land of the Kulin Nations. So thank you for being here. Basically, it was my activism as an Aboriginal person getting started, involved in activism there, that actually led me to become an activist for Palestine as well, because there are so many similarities between the Aboriginal struggle here in Australia and the struggle for in Palestine as well, which I'll cover a little bit in this discussion. I would have liked to have done a really fabulous PowerPoint for you guys, but I ran out of time, so I put that one photo that was up there before. It's gone now. That was taken a year or two ago in Bethlehem, which I just love the photo. I think it's just such a wonderful photo of resistance, of a Palestinian young man standing in the middle of, you know, the Israeli military bombarding the city with tear gas. Okay, so let's get started. So in 1999, renowned Palestinian scholar Edward Said wrote, "Perhaps the greatest battle Palestinians have waged as a people has been over the right to be a remembered presence. With that presence, the right to possess and reclaim a collective historical reality, at least since the Zionist movement began its encroachment on the land. A similar battle has been fought by all colonised people whose past and present were dominated by outside powers who had first conquered the land and then rewrote history so as to appear in that history as the true owners of the land." So he wrote that in Palestine Memory, Invention and Space. As the 70th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba approaches, it is important that we, as socialists, political activists and supporters of the Palestinian struggle for justice, self-determination and freedom, understand the collective historical reality in Palestine and reclaim this reality, challenging the rewriting of history by the Zionist movement and the Israeli state. Israel, like Australia, is a settler colonial state. Settler colonial states are a distinct type of imperialist formation which are premised on the racist elimination of the indigenous population through various means, including ethnic cleansing, genocide, and/or assimilation. Unlike other forms of colonialism that centre on the exploitation of resources, settler colonialism is primarily concerned with the control of territory and the elimination of the indigenous population in order to replace it with a settler population. Before, during and after Israel's foundation, the Zionist movement sought to control as much of historic Palestine as possible, establishing a permanent settler population by eliminating and replacing the indigenous Palestinian Arab population. So we're going to go right back to start off to the birth of Zionism. So political Zionism itself is a product of late capitalism. It was born in the late 19th century in reaction to European anti-Semitism and the waves of anti-Jewish pogroms which swept across Europe and Imperial Russia in the late 19th century. As Abram Leon, the Belgian Jewish Trotskyist, who provided the first comprehensive Marxist understanding of Zionism, explained in 1942, Zionism is essentially a reaction against the situation created for Judaism by the combination and destruction of feudalism and the decay of capitalism. Leon went on to note that Zionist ideology, like all ideologies, is only the distorted reflection of the interests of class. In response to the widespread persecution faced by Jews, a small section of European Jewish petty bourgeois began to subscribe to the idea that anti-Semitism was an inevitable response as long as Jews continued to live among non-Jews, rather than as being a result of the historical developments associated with capitalism. As a result, Zionists began to campaign to establish a national homeland, despite the fact that they did not constitute a national group, but instead an ethno-cultural religious grouping. Herzl, the founding father of Zionism, understood that the world was already carved up into competing colonial powers and that in order to establish a Jewish state, he would need the backing of an imperial power. Herzl made it clear that Palestine was simply one of the many locations for a Jewish homeland, writing in his pamphlet, The Jewish State, Shall We Choose Palestine or Argentina? For almost a decade, from 1895 until his death in 1904, Herzl actively sought support for the Zionist project from representatives of numerous European states, as well as representatives of the Ottoman Empire, under whose control Palestine fell at the time. He even wrote to Cecil Rhodes, perhaps the best known British colonialist of the day, inviting him to help make history by supporting the aim of the Zionist movement. The year before his death in 1904, Herzl enthusiastically accepted the British offer to establish a Jewish state in Uganda. However, in 1905, the Zionist Congress rejected the plan in favour of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine. So in 1908, oil was discovered in Persia, which is present-day Iraq and Iran, ensuring that the Middle East would become central to not only the needs of British imperialism, but European imperialism more broadly. With the vast discovery, the discovery of vast reserves of oil, the British Admiralty, under the leadership of Winston Churchill, converted the British fleet from coal to oil in 1911. Just weeks before the advent of World War I in 1914, Britain purchased a controlling share in the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, later known as British Petroleum, or BP, becoming the only significant oil producer outside of the Americas. Wanting to guarantee their continued access to and control of the Suez Canal, as it offered the most direct route to its colonies in India, and control of Palestine became of vital strategic importance to Britain, both economically and militarily. As World War I drew to a close, Britain began to put into action a secret plan it had drawn up with France in 1916 to carve up the Arab provinces of the dying Ottoman Empire. The Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was revealed to the world when Trotsky and the Bolsheviks made public other secret inter-allied agreements after the Russian Revolution, gave most of Syria and present-day Lebanon to France and Palestine to Britain. The Balfour Declaration, which was used 1 month issued 1 month before Britain seized control of Jerusalem, militarily occupying all of Palestine, was an important strategic manoeuvre to realise Britain's imperialist interests. The purpose of the declaration was to provide a stepping stone for both Britain and for the Zionists, whose interests temporarily coincided. The vast majority of Palestinians would not become aware of the Balfour Declaration until early 1920. With the defeat of Germany and its allies, the Allied imperialist powers met in Paris to carve up the spoils of war, establishing the League of Nations and a mandatory system which placed the former colonies and territories belonging to Germany and the Ottoman Empire under the tutelage of more advanced nations to prepare them for self-determination and independence. However, as Pan-African anti-imperialist and socialist George Padmore noted in 1937, the League of Nations mandatory system was indistinguishable from any other form of colonialism and merely created an illusion that the former German and Ottoman territories were not being annexed by imperialist allied powers. The vast majority of Palestinians only became aware of the declaration when it was incorporated into the mandate protocols for Palestine. In response, they took to the streets in mass demonstrations to oppose both British colonial policy and Zionist settler colonialism. The Allied imperialist powers were well aware that even before these demonstrations that not only Palestinians but the broader Arab population of the Ottoman Empire were stridently opposed to the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. In 1919, the King Crane Commission, established by President Woodrow Wilson, spent 3 months in the Middle East visiting Lebanon, Syria and Palestine. And Jordan, to elucidate the state of opinion of those living there. They collected 1,863 petitions in relation to Syria and Palestine alone, with 72% of them expressing strong opposition to Zionism and the Zionist movement's claim to Palestine. Unsurprisingly, the anti-Zionist settlement was strongest in Palestine, with 222 of the 260 petitions received actively opposing the establishment of a Jewish state. Palestine and Arab opposition, however, was of little importance to Balfour and the British government. According to Balfour, in a memorandum to the incoming British Foreign Minister, and this is a quote, "We do not propose to even go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants. as all the Allied powers were committed to Zionism, and much of this, and this was of, to quote, profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit this ancient land. In 1895, only 14 Jewish colonies existed in Palestine, but by the end of 1919, the number had increased fivefold to 71. During the first Aliyah, which is the name given by Zionists to settler immigration, during the first Aliyah, approximately 30,000 Jews emigrated to Palestine, while another 40,000 Jewish settlers arrived between 1904 and 1914 as part of the second Aliyah. The first Aliyah was primarily comprised of Jewish people of spiritual or religious disposition who returned to Palestine, but not with the aim of establishing a Jewish national homeland. The second Aliyah, however, was dominated by young Jews driven by an ideological adherence to Zionism. Throughout the 1800s, Jewish communities across Europe were forced to endure discriminatory legislation, prohibitions and exclusions, both legally and geographically, and were frequently experienced violence in the form of pogroms, including pogroms that resulted in full-blown ethnic cleansing of towns and regions. In both Tsarist Russia and other parts of Europe, anti-Jewish violence grew in response to the changing economic conditions brought about by the advent and decline of capitalism, as well as the arrival of industrialisation and the racist ideologies emerging in the context of capitalism. In the wake of these pogroms, thousands of young Zionist Jews, believing they had no future in Russia or Europe, emigrated to Palestine, determined to create a new Jewish society with a new Jewish identity. Known collectively as the Halutzim, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, because most of them come to Palestine via the Halutz pioneer movement. Originally, the movement was associated with the non-Zionist Lovers of Zion movement, but the movement was transformed into a Zionist beachhead in 1919 under the leadership of Zionist military leader Joseph Trumpeldor. Under Trumpeldor's leadership, the movement was transformed from a movement aiding religious non-Jewish Jews emigrate to Palestine to a movement of what was called pioneer soldiers. That is a settler worker military force of settlers. For Trumpeldor's second Aliyah Halotzim, the establishment of colonies engaged in agricultural labour and the upbuilding or the construction of the Jewish state and the transformation of Arab Palestine into a national Jewish homeland was the highest form of Zionist activity. As part of the nascent labour Zionist movement, the Halotzim embraced fully the twin Zionist doctrines of the conquest of labour and Hebrew labour. The conquest of labour sought to transform what were largely lower middle class Jewish settler immigrants into preferably agrarian worker pioneers through physical labour for the national cause, while Hebrew labour, the doctrine of Hebrew labour, sought to create a new exclusivist Jewish working class through the expulsion and replacement of existing indigenous Arab labour in all sectors of the Jewish economy in Palestine. Not only would adherence to these doctrines create and preserve employment opportunities in Palestine for Zionist settler colonialists, they would also ensure the creation of a separate, high-wage, exclusively Jewish economy in Palestine that would make possible the eventual creation of a viable Jewish state. However, as one of Trumpeldor's closest collaborators and leader of the right wing of the Zionist movement, Vladimir Jabotinsky, explained in 1927, and this is a fairly long quote for him, "If you wish to colonise a land in which people are already living, you must provide a garrison on your behalf. Or else give up your colonisation, for without an armed force, which will render physically impossible any attempts to destroy or prevent this colonisation, colonisation is impossible. Not difficult, not dangerous, but impossible. Zionism is a colonising adventure, and therefore it stands or falls by the question of armed force. It is important to build... And it's important to speak Hebrew, but unfortunately it is even more important to be able to shoot, or else I am through with playing at colonisation." Thus, as pioneer workers, soldiers, the role of the Halutzim was not only to establish new Zionist colonies, create an exclusive Jewish working class, but also to defend the Zionist settler colonial project and the acquisition of territory needed to establish a Jewish state. As active members of the Zionist paramilitary groups such as the Haganah, which can be seen as the forerunner today's Israeli occupation forces, They participated and trained and fought as part of that. By 1930, more than 6,000 Halutsum were active serving members of the Haganah. Throughout the 1920s and 30s, the Haganah and the Zionist movement smuggled large quantities of firearms into Palestine. In the 1930s, the Zionist community in Palestine established secret weapon manufacturing sites in order to produce ammunition, small hand weapons, hand grenades, bombs, other explosives, while also sending trusted members of the Haganah to Europe to learn weapon manufacturing and to engage in arms running and smuggling. Throughout this period, the Haganah carried out military training, training officers in particular on how to use different weapons, including machine guns. They also started to acquire one or two aeroplanes as part of a nascent air force. Despite this, David Ben-Gurion and the leadership of the Labour Zionist movement in the Yeshiv, which was the Jewish community in Palestine, he believed that the Yeshiv was not yet strong enough to establish itself independently of British patronage. Because of both demographic and military weaknesses of the Yeshiv, the primary focus of the Zionist movement at this time was to continue further immigration in order to change the demographic composition of the population of Palestine and to focus on the upbuilding of the Jewish state under the protection of the British. As a result, throughout the early 1930s, the Haganah's use of political violence remained predominantly defensive rather than offensive at that time. So what about the Palestinians? So, betrayed by the British, the Palestinians railed against both British imperial policy and Zionist settler colonialism, with riots erupting in 1920 and 1921, demanding the cancellation of the Balfour Declaration. This demand would also be the central focus of every Arab Congress held by the Palestinian National Movement during the period of the British Mandate. In addition, when Britain attempted to placate the Palestinians by offering to establish a legislative council, the Palestinians voted to boycott it after extensive debate because the structure of the council only worked to reinforce rather than challenge British policy and the Balfour Declaration. In 1925, Palestinians launched a series of general strikes in opposition to British rule and Zionist settler colonialism. In 1920, riots broke out once again, resulting in the death of 133 Jews and 116 Palestinians. The riots came primarily in reaction to increased Zionist immigration and land purchases. Throughout the early 1930s, Palestinians would continue to agitate against British support for the Zionist project, culminating in one of the longest general strikes in history, lasting more than 170 days. I know at the opening night, comrades were talking about 1968 as being the greatest general strike in sort of modern history. And I was like, what about, you know, Palestine? What about 36 in Palestine? So it was one of the longest general strikes in history, lasting more than 170 days, and it was an anti-colonial revolt which would engulf all of Palestine for 3 years, between 1936 and 1939. Between 1922 and 1929, the Jewish population in Palestine had almost tripled, increasing from 11% to 28% by 1929 as a result of Zionist immigration. In the first 8 months of 1933 alone, more than 16,000 Zionist immigrants entered Palestine either via legal channels approved by the British government, and there were 1,000 more who entered illegally. By the 1930s, Zionist colonisation and land purchases had resulted in the eviction of more than 20,000 Palestinians from their land that their families had worked for centuries. By 1930, 30% of Palestinian fellaheen, or peasants, were landless. By 1931, approximately 1 million dunams of land, almost one-third of agricultural land that had been expropriated from them, while another third of the remaining plots were too small for subsistence for Palestinian families to survive on. Palestinian fellaheen, forced off the land, moved to shanty towns on the edge of Palestinian cities where they provided cheap labour for the urban population. Where work was available, the hours were often long and the conditions extremely poor. In Jaffa, most of the street cleaners who worked there were ex-villagers. As mentioned earlier, the Zionist Halutsum embraced the twin doctrines of the conquest of labour and Hebrew labour in order to create a new exclusivist Jewish working class in Palestine. David Harcohen, a leading member of MAPI, the Labor Party, recalled in 1969 how the doctrine of Hebrew labour and the conquest of labour unfolded in practice. And this is a direct quote for him. "I had to fight my friends to defend the fact that I would not accept Arabs in my trade union, the Histadrut, to defend preaching to housewives that they not buy from Arab stores, to defend the fact that we stood guard at orchards to prevent Arab workers from getting jobs there, to pour kerosene on Arab tomatoes, to attack Jewish housewives in the market and smash the Arab eggs they'd brought, to praise to the sky the Karim Komet, which is the Jewish fund, that sent Hankin to Beirut to buy land from absentee Effendi landlords, and to throw the fellaheen, or peasants, off the land, to buy dozens of dunams from the Arabs is permitted, but to sell, God forbid, one Jewish dunam to the Arab is prohibited." So in 1935, Zionists controlled 872 of the 1,212 industrial farms in Palestine, employing around 13,500 workers. The rest, the other 340, were Palestinian Arab controlled and employed only about 4,000 workers. At the time, Zionist capital controlled around 90% of the concessions granted by the British mandatory government and provided labour for around 2,600 workers. An official census in 1937 indicated that the average Jewish worker in Palestine received 145% more in wages than his Palestinian Arab counterpart. So that's a huge difference. So the catalyst for the revolt in 1936 was a clash between Palestinian bandits and Jewish travellers, which resulted in the death of two Jewish travellers on April 15 in 1936. The following day, two Palestinian peasants were murdered in retaliation by the Haganah. This fueled already existing tensions between the two communities. On April 17, after the funeral of one of the Jewish travellers, Zionists began staging demonstrations outside of Jewish shops, demanding that they fire Palestinian workers, and a series of unprovoked attacks were carried out against Palestinian workers and residents in Yaffa and Tel Aviv. After two days of not responding to the Jewish provocations, rumours of Arab deaths at the hands of the yeshiv spread like wildfire through the Palestinian community. Violence erupted and resulted in the death of five Palestinians and 16 Jews between April 19 and April 22. Altogether, in the 3 or 4 days clashes, 72 Palestinians were killed. 72 Palestinians were also injured, and another 75 Jews were also injured. As Zionists' attacks on Palestinian workers continued, the Palestinian Iskatal, or Independence Party, in Nablus, and Palestinian nationalists in Yaffa issued a call for a national strike on April 18. By April 20, Nablus, Yaffa and Tal Karim were on full strike. Within a few days, the strike had spread to the whole Palestinian community as towns and villages joined the call to action. On April 25, delegations representing the Palestinian political parties and strike committees, basically every town set up a strike committee, met in Jerusalem to form the Higher Arab Committee. Its first act was to reaffirm the demands that had been long part of the Palestinian national movement, an immediate end to Zionist immigration, a prohibition on Arab land sales to settlers, and the establishment of a national government which would be elected democratically on the basis of one person, one vote. On May 2, the Car Owners and Drivers Committee, which was one of the backbones of the general strike, who had already declared a general strike of all Arab transport facilities, called for the non-payment of taxes. Shopkeepers also joined the strike by closing their doors, while Palestinian farmers supported the general strike by selling their produce in Palestinian towns only during specified hours. So you had to go and buy it, you know, between 10 and 12 or something like that. All state schools closed, as did a number of Christian schools, with many of the students forming strike committees and picketing private mission schools that remained open. Women also played an active part in the revolt, while middle-class and urban women often played a role collecting funds for the strike fund and things like that. Many working-class women and peasant women would eventually join the guerrilla forces, which would engage in armed struggle. By early May, the general strike was steadfast and widespread, and most Arab commerce and transport was completely at a standstill, and the Palestinians had staged more than 120 rallies and demonstrations demanding an end to Zionist colonisation and an independence for Palestine. In August, the rail workers finally joined the strike. They had been the only sector that hadn't been part of the strike in the transport sector. I could have written so much more, but I cut out so much from this talk. I won't go into why that was, but there was specific conditions why that happened. They had been the lone sector of the transport industry which had not joined in May. They were also joined by Palestinian Arab workers at the Shell and IKEA petroleum companies, public works department and municipal employees. So the general strike lasted from April to October 1936. Due to British repression of the strike, including bulldozing and destruction of whole Palestinian neighbourhoods, by mid-May, formerly disparate acts of sabotage and violence had crystallised into a fully armed insurgency waged from the Arab quarters of mixed cities in places around the Galilee, Nablus and Jerusalem. When the second stage of the Palestinian revolt erupted in 1937, the revolt was actually in two stages. Again, I just don't have time to go through everything. The first stage was in 36, then there was a sort of break where negotiations happened for about 6 months, and then it re-erupted again in mid-1937. When the second stage of the revolt erupted in 1937, it was dominated by the armed struggle, primarily because Britain had been able to effectively repress Palestinian civil society, and particularly they repressed totally the strike committees, which had been the driving force behind the general strike. The Palestinian guerrilla resistance, both in the first stage and the second stage of revolt, carried out attacks on roads, transport vehicles, railways, bridges, telephone lines, and the oil pipes and agricultural structures. So it was quite a significant strike. Okay, at the height of the revolt, it was estimated that there was between 5,000 and 8,000 guerrilla fighters who carried out more than 800 attacks on British mandate police and military facilities, 380 attacks on British communication facilities such as railways and highways, and there had been more than 1,300 bombs thrown at these facilities. In addition, Palestinian guerrillas staged more than 2,000 attacks on Zionist colonies and properties, resulting in the destruction of 200,000 fruit trees and forests, and 17,000 dunams of crops were destroyed. During these battles, there was also the death of 82 Zionist colonists. Britain would only succeed in putting down the revolt after it mobilised 20,000 British troops and 14,500 members of the Zionist militias. More than 5,000 Palestinians were killed, with hundreds hung for their role in the insurrection. Hundreds more were deported from their own country, and tens of thousands were locked up in internment camps. Under emergency laws, Britain also instituted harsh acts of collective punishment, such as the destruction of Palestinian homes and the bombing of entire Palestinian villages. These are collective punishments that Israel still uses today in the occupied territories and Gaza. Today the Israeli state continues to replicate many of these harsh acts. The Zionist movement used the collaboration with the British to increase their military capabilities. By 1937, more than 3,000 Zionists were serving in the colonial police forces in some capacity. By 1939, between 15,000 to 20,000 Zionists were part of the Palestine security forces in some way or another, whether being policemen, supernumeraries or settlement guards. The suppression of the 1936 to 1939 revolt would lay the groundwork for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1947 and 1948. Having crushed the Palestinian resistance during the revolt, the British then would abandon Palestine to the Zionists in this time. In 1947, the UN decided to petition Palestine against the will of the indigenous Palestinian Arabs, proposing to hand over 54% of the territory to the Zionists. At the time, the Zionist population, Jewish population at the time, was around 33% of the total population, while Palestinian Arabs made up 67%. In the months leading up to the proposed petition, between December 1947 and April 1948, Zionist militias carried out strategic attacks on Palestinian cities and villages, terrorising and killing thousands of Palestinian civilians. Under the leadership of David Ben-Gurion, Zionist militias launched Plan Dalit in April 1948, beginning the forcible expulsion of 1 million Palestinians from 418 of the 476 Palestinian cities and towns and villages. This resulted in 750,000 Palestinians fleeing to neighbouring states, while another 150,000 became internally displaced refugees inside the newly established state, Zionist state. Of the 418 Palestinian villages and towns ethnically cleansed, 385 were completely destroyed as Israel seized control of 78% of historic Palestine. The Zionists were able to do this because, having worked hand-in-hand with the British for almost three decades, they had succeeded in building a well-trained military force that enjoyed military superiority over the Palestinians and the so-called invading Arab hordes from the outside states. As Avi Schleim, one of the Israel's new historians, by mid-May of 1948, when the British had pulled out of Palestine, the total number of Arab troops, both regular and irregular, operating in Palestine was under 25,000, whereas the Israeli Defence Force fielded over 35,000 troops. By mid-July, Israeli troops numbered 65,000, increasing to 96,000 by December 1948. In addition, Zionist forces were better trained and disciplined than the Arab forces. He notes, the final outcome of the war was therefore not a miracle, but a faithful reflection of the underlying military balance of power in the Palestine theatre. So now we're going to get to Israel 1948 onwards. So today, Israel is often touted as the only democracy in the Middle East. However, since its founding in 1948, it has been an openly racist and apartheid state, using both legally sanctioned discrimination and military force to ethnically cleanse and oppress the indigenous Palestinian population. Since 1948, Israel has imposed an apartheid system inside the Zionist state, further extending this apartheid regime in 1967 when it seized control of Gaza, West Bank, and East Jerusalem. I want to make clear first, though, but when we use the term apartheid here to describe the Israeli state, I'm not using it flippantly or just as some empty slogan. Israel is an apartheid state because its actions fit the UN definition of apartheid enshrined in the 1973 International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid. Article 2 of the 1973 Convention identifies apartheid not only as being the denial of members of a racial group the right to life, the infliction of arbitrary arrest, illegal imprisonment, serious bodily harm, and other things such as that. Apartheid is constituted also by denying members of a racial group or groups basic human rights and freedoms, with this including the right to nationality, education, employment, freedom of opinion, expression, peaceful assembly, association, freedom of residence and movement, including the right to leave and return their country. There's actually heaps more that I've listed, but I'm not going to go into it because of time. But you should look up the convention and you can see and basically tick things off. One of the first laws passed by the newly established Israel in 1949 was the absentee property laws, which allowed the confiscation of land and property belonging to more than 1 million Palestinians who had been forced to flee their homeland by the Zionist militias. The Palestinian homes and property and land confiscated by Israel was immediately handed over to Jewish settlers and ex-soldiers, with more than 170,000 resettled into Palestinian homes by July 1948. Between 1949 and 1966, Palestinian citizens of Israel were also forced to live under martial law. Unlike Jewish citizens of the Zionist state, Palestinian citizens were regularly subject to curfews and political repression. Israeli military governors basically ruled the lives of Palestinians with impunity. Despite being citizens of Israel, Palestinians could not leave or enter their towns without permits. Restrictions were placed on their education and employment, as well as their political activity, and Palestinian political organisations were banned. Writing for Haaretz newspaper, I know I've pronounced that wrong, sorry, on the 16th of June 2013, Palestinian activist and novelist Odia Bisharat recounted his own family's experience under Israel's military regime between 1949 and 1966. In addition to the daily struggle to obtain exit permits to work in, as he puts it, Jewish cities, Bushrat knows that the Shin Bet, or Israel's secret police, and its network of collaborators and informants were omnipresent in the lives of all Palestinians, ensuring, and this is a quote, ensuring that the military administration settled in our homes, nestled between the sheets of our beds, between father and son, man and wife, until everything seemed suspect. According to researcher Sarah Ozaki-Laza, Israel's military rule, again a quote, penetrated all areas of civilian life and became a state instrument for political, economic, social control of the Arab minority. Despite martial law formally ending in 1966, Palestinian citizens of Israel are still not afforded the same democratic and civil rights as Jewish citizens. According to Israel's Israeli human rights group Adala, the legal centre for the Arab minority in Israel, since 1948, more than 50 discriminatory laws have been enacted against Palestinians who make up 20% of Israel's population. According to Adala, these laws undermine the most basic legal protections, rights and freedoms, including the right to vote, to be elected, to political expression, essential procedural safeguards for detainees, and the ownership of property. There are one of the most noticeable are the citizenship laws, as well as Haweda mentioned the other day, the panels that can prevent people from going in and out of being accepted into different communities. So in 1967, Israel launched the Six-Day War in order to conquer the rest of Palestine, occupying East Jerusalem, Gaza and the West Bank. Since that time, Palestinians living in the occupied territories have been forced to live under military occupation, with Israel issuing more than 3,000 military regulations to govern Palestinians in these territories. These military orders can be issued at the whim of any military commander. It can be issued at the whim of a military camp commander and don't need to be publicised. So often, this has happened many times, that the military can issue these new orders and Palestinians have no idea that they even exist. And then they get arrested for doing something against these military orders, not even knowing that the military order exists. I've seen that with my own eyes. So these military orders affect every aspect of Palestinian life, including legal identity, education, employment, healthcare, housing, freedom of movement and political activity. Palestinians don't have any recourse to challenge these laws. In 1970, Israel authorised the use of administrative detention, which allows for the detention and arrest of a large number of Palestinian civilians without charge or trial. In 1988, the military order was amended to allow Palestinians to be now detained under administrative detention without designating a maximum period of time for incarceration without charge or trial. Under this regime, detained Palestinians, along with their lawyers, have no right to know what they are accused of, and they have no right to access the military's evidence being used against them. According to Adamir, the Palestinian Political Prisoners Support Group and Human Rights Association, more than 40% of the male Palestinian population, including minors, of the occupied territories, have been detained since 1967. According to both Israeli and Palestinian human rights organisation, nearly all Palestinian political prisoners, both male and female, including minors, have suffered torture while imprisoned by Israel. The association estimates that since the beginning of the first Intifada in 1987, at least 30,000 Palestinians had been tortured by Israel. And this figure is actually from about 4 years ago. So who knows now? Palestinians are also subject to other forms of punitive punishment and restrictions under Israel's military apartheid regime in the occupied territories, including regular destruction of Palestinian homes, the destruction of land and crop, as well as the restriction of freedom of movement and the prevention of the use of roads and entering areas reserved only for Zionist settler colonists. In addition, under this apartheid regime, Palestinian water resources and land are regularly confiscated and redirected for Jewish use only in these illegal colonies. Today, Israel remains an expansionist settler colonial state. In the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, Israel continues to steal Palestinian land and ethnically cleanse the Palestinians in order to build illegal settlements. A report by the United Nations in 2012 on the right to housing condemned Israel, saying, from the Galilee and the Negev to the East Jerusalem and the West Bank, The Israeli authorities promote a territorial development model that excludes, discriminates and against and displaces minorities, particularly affecting Palestinian communities, side by side with the accelerated development of predominantly Jewish settlements. So Palestinians, however, have continued to struggle against Israel apartheid and against the racist regime being imposed on them, both inside the Israeli state and in the occupied Palestinian territories. In recent days, we've seen more than 20,000 Palestinians trapped in the open-air prison called Gaza stage a march of return. They set up tents on their own agricultural land to protest Israel's occupation and blockade. Israel responded by opening fire on unarmed civilians, murdering at least six of them, I think the figure is higher now, within hours. My good friend Moshea, who some of you who are from Melbourne might know, was studying here at Melbourne University a few years back, reported on Facebook that while he and a friend were simply standing in the field, he is a lecturer at one of the universities in Gaza, They were simply standing in the field, and the IOF, Israeli occupation forces, opened fire on him and his friend, with his friend being shot in the leg. So they were just lucky they weren't killed. As Palestinian journalist Yusuf Munir noted on Twitter in response to the Western media's report of clashes, he said this: "They are not clashes when one is shooting and the other is getting shot. Snipers are shooting protesters from hundreds of metres away. The only thing clashing is Israeli bullets into Palestinian bodies." And I just want to read, Haweda showed me this earlier today. Give me 2 seconds to find it. The IOF, none of this is an accident. Everybody makes out the Israeli occupation forces. They like to make out they are the most moral army in the world. They are far from the most moral army in the world. So the Israeli occupation spokesperson actually tweeted this and then later deleted it, and this is what they tweeted. "Yesterday we saw 30,000 people. We arrived prepared with precise reinforcements. Nothing was carried out uncontrolled. Everything was accurate and measured. We know where every bullet landed." So they knew it wasn't, an accident. They were shooting to kill and shooting to injured. There was footage of people simply walking in their fields, doing nothing, and being shot. So this is the murderous regime that we are contending with. So what do we as activists, socialists, human rights supporters do here in Australia? Well, of course, we can join the campaign for Palestinian rights. We can support the BDS campaign, which was initiated in 2005 and is being led by Palestinian civil society. You can join your local Palestine solidarity group, and you can be part of the Nakba rallies that are coming up. We, as was mentioned here before, there will be an emergency rally happening here in Melbourne this coming Saturday, and then we will also be organising rallies for Nakba Day on May 19th. The reality is the Palestinians have been in struggle for more than 100 years, struggling for their rights, they've been struggling for their land, and they've been struggling for their dignity. And they have remained samud, and samud means steadfast. They have remained steadfast through all this time, through the horrors that they have had to face. And it is up to us to also remain steadfast, and it's up to us to remain samud. Because if they have not given up, then we, in our comfortable homes here in Australia or the US or Europe or wherever we might be, also cannot give up. So we need to be standing in solidarity. You can do it in many different ways. Some people can't get to meetings. Some people can't get to protests. But if you can, you should come. Write letters. Do everything you can. You can write to your politicians, write to the media. You can talk to your friends. You can organise film showings to show what's going on. So please become active. It is most important, because it's time, after all of these years, with 70 years of the Nakba this year, it is time we finally win a free Palestine.